All right, so this is lesson 14. Our last lesson covers chapter 26 through 28. And of course, as soon as I started doing it, I thought, what was I thinking combining these two lessons? You know, what I was thinking was, oh, they're short chapters. You know, we can do that easily. I wasn't thinking about content. And I just thought, there's no way. There's absolutely no way we can cover all this. So I kind of opted to go with just the theme of Matthew and not pick apart every single little thing, although sometimes I'll just throw in some stuff just because it's so cool. But of any chapters in the Bible, these are probably the chapters that you know the most, that you've heard the most sermons on, that you've perhaps even done the most study on. So I don't feel like I have to go through all the ideas of atonement, victory, all of the salvation ideas. I'm not going to go through those. But I will go through what Matthew's theme is about. And particularly, I wonder if you noticed, as you went through the Passion and Crucifixion and Resurrection stories, if you realize how little Matthew puts in.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's really narrow. In fact, the crucifixion is, I think, like two verses. I mean, it's just really right there. Because he's getting at a different picture than, perhaps, say, Luke, who puts in a lot more. Mark is just as kind of narrowed, although Matthew is probably the most narrowed for the crucifixion. So it's interesting that what we would consider putting the bulk of stuff in, Matthew doesn't. Because remember, he is addressing what kind of an audience?
Religious.
He's addressing the religious audience. And a religious audience says, you live by what should be. Remember? You live by what is right, what should be. And that's kind of the religious audience's thought. So Matthew, again, is going to look at things very differently than Mark, Luke, or John did. Definitely. It's interesting, though, how even as I studied this, I continued to think that what I was thinking about was in Matthew, and it's not. It was in another one. And I think, wow, how did I, you just insert it all together. So I will insert just some, a few little things, just because they're cool and they actually fit what Matthew wants to tell us. But most of it will stay with Matthew. So the religious audience that he's talking to, remember, they're the ones who've put the kingdom in a box. And with the only way of getting into that box being some kind of a transaction. They've been so afraid of losing access to that box, to that Holy of Holies, to that special place of heaven meeting earth, that they've needed to protect it. And so they kind of hoard it like that. And does that remind you of any parable of having something they need to protect because they might lose it? And so they...
The guy that buries his talent.
Exactly, the guy that buries his talent, which is exactly the picture that Matthew's trying to give of the religious. That's exactly what they do with the kingdom of God. They're so afraid of losing it when God says, you'll never lose me. This is a gift here, and let it grow. Let it be what it is on its own. And then because they do that, then they only mete it out to those who are deserving or worthy or who they're sure can keep the standards up, who are sure that can protect it just like them. That's where the religious are coming from. That and remember when we say that, when we say the religious audience, remember that it applies to today. I think the one thing that you need to get out of Matthew is when he talks about the Pharisees over and over and over and over and over again, he's talking about the Pharisees of today as well, that they are not a group that was unique. Mm-hmm. They're actually a very common group, although they consider themselves unique and holy. They're actually probably the most common group. So I think in one of the commentaries, they, instead of calling them Pharisees or the religious, they call them the serious Bible students, which I think is a, kind of a, you know, it just jars you like, well, wait, no, serious Bible students would do that. But that's exactly what they're talking about here. The problem with them, as they put the kingdom in a box and they only deem it out to people who are worthy, is they've lost sight of the fact that it's actually a gift to them, that they won't ever lose a relationship with God. The gift, though, needs to be shared. It needs to be given. It needs to be open without all sorts of boundaries around it and hedges around it. But because they've forgotten that, and because they want to protect it, they begin using the only methods they know, and that is the world's methods. They use transactional methods. They use, and always transactional methods will be methods of force, methods of strength, methods of what we consider power. They will use that to make sure to protect. When you think about it, when you talk about protecting something, protecting your own property, what are the first things you think about using to protect? Depending, no matter what it is.
Weapons,
right? You think about weapons.
Alarms.
Locks. See, these, right, sandbags, there you go, sandbags, perfect. Fences, if you're a gardener, all of these things are things to make sure that no one gets, I mean, there is this positive pushback, right? And that's really what the religious have used throughout the centuries to protect what is holy. They've used these boundaries, these methods of force, power, to keep out what is not holy. But Matthew is determined to show what true religion is. Remember, this is how we started Matthew, in saying Matthew is all about religio, the Latin, which means to retie, to tie again, to bind together again. That's what real religion is about, is retying reality, retying heaven and earth. And that's Matthew's whole gist, is we are going to retie heaven and earth. We're going to show what true religion is, what what God is trying to do all the way from the very beginning to now. And in order to retie heaven and earth, to retie reality, it's going to mean breaking barriers rather than putting up barriers. The problem is, how in the world do we break barriers when all we know how to do is build barriers? We know how to create them. We know how to build them. We don't know how to tear down what we've built. Not only do we not know how to do it so much, is it's something that we become reluctant to. If you've built something that you think is beautiful, how easy is it for you to decide to tear it down?
Pretty hard.
Yeah, pretty difficult. We were just talking about Jamie moving, going over there. And Kim said, I don't know, it seems so hard to be able to say, no, I'm not taking that. All of these things you've built up as your life, now you have to let go. And it becomes a process, right, that's hard, that's difficult, and a lot of decisions. So we don't do that well. We don't break down barriers well. We don't take away the little kingdoms that we've made to protect what we think is life. So how then do we go about that? If that's what reality is, if that's what religion is, if that's what God is calling us to see the kingdom means to break down all of our barriers, how in the world do we do something we have no idea how to do, and our nature is almost to be reluctant to do that? Well, that's the whole message of the last three chapters of Matthew, is you don't know how to do it, and no, you can't do break down all the barriers, but there is one who does know how to do it and who can do that. So that's how he kind of goes into what we know as the Passion and the Crucifixion. So we're going all the way back to the beginning, reminding us of what Matthew's theme was. It is to retie reality. And in that, to retie it in three different ways. To be able to see the holy in the common. So to retie the holy and the common, because religious separate that, right? That's all they're about. This is holy, and we've got to keep it separate from what is common. Matthew says, no, it's just the opposite. We need to retie the holy and the common, see the holy in the common. We need to see compassion in the law, whereas the religious say the law is the end. So law and compassion are separate things. We also need to find truth in relationship, and we've talked about that a lot before, where the religious say, no, this is truth, and it has nothing to do with relationship. Everything is fact. We live by that. So, finding the holy in the common, we're going to start there, which is the opposite. And what we're going to do is look at all the contrasts that Matthew has. If nothing else, Matthew is a book of contrasts. It is a contrasting between a transactional life and a transformational life. A contrast between the kind of life that the kingdom is bringing and that the kingdom is about and the kind of life that this world is about. And he does that with a lot of different characters, but no more so than in these last three chapters. Every character he brings up is going to be contrasted with another character. Every story he brings up is going to be contrasted so that you see this over and over and over again, the contrast between the two, and see where their outcome is. So we of course know that Jesus is the one who can see the holy and the common. He knows that real life only comes through dying to that separated life, to dying to that, to the, all those barriers, to the separation, because real life's priority is relationship. John would call it love. That would be the first priority of real life. Matthew calls it relationship, which is why he has so many relationship words in Matthew. Of all Gospels, Matthew has the most, like beyond the most. The other side of it is trying to keep the holy holy and trying to keep the holy away from the common. They strive and use all their power available in order to achieve what they think is life. And to be fair to the Pharisees and to be fair to those of us who have been Pharisees who are still struggling with that, we're not trying to do an evil thing. We think we're trying to do good. We think we're trying to keep God's name holy and majestic and above all. We just have a wrong idea because we've taken the idea from the world. I don't remember where I got this quote, but I thought it was a good one. Force and violence are the alternatives to true power. They are where one turns when you are too weak to dare risking vulnerability. Which is exactly what Jesus does do. Because he knows that relationship, love, is the first priority in the kingdom, he's willing to risk the vulnerability in what looks like weakness. Vulnerability always looks like weakness, right? But we just had two stories. Sherilyn shared that story, and I did, of this vulnerability of saying, this is where I'm afraid, and that was strength. What Grant said to Sherilyn was actually strength. It was huge for him to say that. I've worked with Grant before, and I've had as much difficulty as Sherilyn because, like, what do you mean you don't know how to use a hammer? Really? Grant, just this. No, I don't know how to use a hammer. Wow. See, that's the strength. Not me going, come on, guy, what's wrong with you? It's the strength is saying, this is who I am. I don't know how to use that. I don't know how to do that. That's what the Beatitudes were about, right? This is what God goes toward. This is what God heals. This is what God saves. Not the strength. So risking vulnerability really has a lot to do with finding the holy in the common, which on the outside, it doesn't look like they would have anything in common, and yet they have everything to do with one another. So what we're going to do is go through each of the stories in Matthew and kind of look at those stories. So the first three stories really fit under finding the holy in the common. And looking at the contrast between Jesus finding the holy in the common and all the other characters trying to separate the holy and the common. So the very first story we have is the devotion of the woman. I don't even know if she's named here. So, and I'm always going to have to look back. It's in the other scriptures, it's Mary that anoints him with the perfume. So we have Jesus receiving the anointing. He receives it from Mary, who is bent over, who is a picture of a little one, a least one. But where is it that he is doing this? What's the setting? At a leper's home, at Simon the leper's home. What do we have here now? We have a leper and we have a woman, right? The least in that society, the very least. And Jesus looks at them both and says, these people have done a wonderful thing. These people are preparing me for my burial, for my death. And so he sees the death in it in many ways. And let me say this. I am not going to go really deep into any of these, but in each of these things, there is so much farther more you could go. Jesus is seeing the death in everything. And every time he sees the death, he takes it to himself. He takes it to himself. So there's a death here, first of all, of trying to keep a separated life. Death to keeping a separated life, which was what he was taught as a good Jewish man. That's what he was taught. Keep a separated life. That's what we're taught, right? I mean, I've heard it a million times. You're supposed to be holy. You're supposed to be separate, right? Really wrong idea of what Scripture talks about. But that's exactly what religious wants to do, is keep the holy separate. And Jesus dies to that, what he's been taught. Our opposite side, our contrast is, we have them first in the court of the high priest, which is interesting because the court of the high priest is like a palace. It actually is called a palace in some places. So we have the leper's home and the palace. So we look at that right away. And it's not just a palace, but it's the palace of the priest. The high priest. So we have the holy and the common, right? And Jesus is in the common, finding there the death to embrace, whereas at the priest's court, the palace, and if you've been there where they've kind of rebuilt that, it's pretty nice. I mean, I'd like that as a home. It's very nice. So what does the woman do? What does she give Jesus?
The perfume.
The perfume, right? It says here a costly perfume. From the other Gospels, we know that the perfume was the equivalent of a year's worth salary. So that's how much it would have cost. I think, did they say it's nard? Mm-hmm. I think it's nard, right? Which you can still get, and it's still expensive. So it's quite a costly thing. The contrasting story we have is of Judas going to the chief priest's palace to ask for something for himself. So we have a woman giving away a year's worth salary to Jesus. And rarely would there be a woman who had that. And here was Judas, who was supposedly connected to Jesus, seeking to get money for himself so that he could get his picture accomplished, and we'll talk about his picture in just a second. But do you, how much did he get for that?
30 coins.
30 pieces of silver. That's an Old Testament, very common number. Does anyone know what that price would be for? Remember when we did Deuteronomy, and there were all those lists of prices for, if you kill a man who has a child, it will be this price. If you do this and this, 30 pieces of silver is the price for a slave who's been gored by a bull. So that's the amount that they considered was worth Jesus. So in other words, the price of a slave who was gored, in other words, an injured slave would get 30 pieces of silver. In other words, that's nothing. It's nothing for a life, but it's considered good enough for a slave who is injured and can't do his work. And of course, then you begin to see all the pictures of Christ as the servant who is gored, who is pierced, would be the word in the New Testament. So what we have then here is this contrast between the common and the holy, but Jesus finding the holy in the common, and the holy people trying to keep their holiness separate by paying for, by using force, using power that they have to keep what they considered common out. Jesus out, right? That's their... So money will be used a lot of times as power. Is that true today?
Yes.
Absolutely. In fact, that's probably the most thing we do. Even in our good stuff, we use money so I don't have to get my hands dirty, right? It becomes then a barrier, which it is here. So that's the very beginning story that we have and starts to show you contrast. Now, are you understanding where we're going with these contrasts and how we see the difference between the two? And really what Matthew wants us to come to is, which one really gives life? Yeah, the one over here looks like, all the time it looks like, oh, this is not going to end well. But this is why he, like Paul, kind of brings us down in this lawyerly fashion until at the end we realize, oh, all of this stuff, this column here that looked like death, that's actually where you get life. And all this stuff where people are trying to protect life and trying to make sure that life is maintained, status quo, that ends up being black and dead. So that's kind of where we're going from here. I wasn't quite sure how to outline that well, so I hope that makes sense to you as we do that. So going into the Passover meal, which is probably my favorite. Oh, I was going to bring, well, I guess we won't do that. My Jewish friend had too much matzah left over, and so she gave me a box of matzah because she knows that I usually do the Passover meal. We weren't here to do that on Good Friday. So, but we're going to talk about the Passover meal as we get into 26 and starting with 17. So you'll notice that I've kind of gone through all the verses, but kind of taken the main story out of that. So we have Jesus promising healing within the Passover meal. How does that look? What does that look like? It contrasts with, he talks about the disciples falling away. He talks about Judas, but he also talks about all the other disciples falling away. His first desire, he says to the three disciples, go and prepare the meals because I want to be with my disciples. He says it two or three times. I want to be with my disciples. If you didn't catch that in all three chapters, with becomes, again, a huge key word in all three chapters, which is really the whole point of Jesus. I want to be with you. I'm going to make it possible for you to be with me. So the contrast is he seeks to be with the disciples. The disciples will seek to be away from him. There's the contrast there. So Jesus' desire is to celebrate Passover with them. What he knows is he wants to institute for them a new Passover, a new Exodus for them. He wants to evoke for them the old Passover, what had happened, but then he wants to charge it with some new meaning so that they begin to understand what will happen afterwards. I won't go through all the little really cool details about the fact that all of this actually happens during the Passover time, that it all mimics. We've gone through that in many other studies. But he wants to say to them, look, this is a new Exodus, and I'm beginning to take down the wall, the Red Sea wall. Remember, there was a wall there of the Red Sea. I'm going to begin to take that down in what I'm going to do. And I want to introduce to you what is going to be happening here. And so for him, he is beginning to explain what's going to happen in the next several hours for him and for them as well. So, of course, he takes the bread, he blesses it, he breaks it, and he gives it. Does that bring to mind anything else that's happened in Matthew?
Feeding of the 5,000.
Yeah, and the feeding of the 4,000, right? Exact same words. He takes, he blesses, he breaks, and he gives. So it's the same, it's supposed to remind us of that. But for them, it's also going to evoke the Passover. When he does that, they're reminded that this is a covenant meal, that this is a meal of huge importance, of a big promise. And so, of course, then we need the background of covenant. How many here have not gone through covenant? So just one or two? Okay. I'll explain really quickly the picture of covenant. How many of you remember what happens when God made a covenant or anybody made a covenant? What was the practice to show what happened in the covenant?
The sacrifice and the splitting of the pieces and walking through the death.
Okay. So when someone would make a covenant, which is the most solemn oath that you can make, they would take an animal, and this is Genesis 15 where God and Abraham cuts the stuff, but God does the walking, takes an animal, splits it in half, puts it on one side and the other, and then the covenant partners walk through the pieces of the split animal. Why? What is that a symbolic of? What does that say?
May the same thing happen to me that happened to the same one that I break.
Yes. So it's this covenant is so important that as I walk through these, I am saying, if I break this covenant, may the same thing happen to me as has happened to these animals. So that's the solemnness of the covenant. It's also one of the pictures that we have in a wedding ceremony. It's why, up until recently, we had the groom's side and the bride's side, and the bride and groom walk down, they leave walking down that aisle, they're walking between the pieces. They're saying, if I break this covenant, may the same thing happen to me. Death till death do us part, right? So that's that picture. That's the only picture we've really retained from the practice of putting a covenant into effect. A covenant always is two becoming one. It's always a commitment to a shared and dependent life. That's always what covenant is. So when they eat the Passover meal, they understand that they're eating a covenant meal. They would have a meal after that to celebrate their oneness. So this contract is a very common thing for the Middle Eastern world. It continues to be common. When we call covenants here, we completely misname them because they're not covenants so much as promises or contracts. So when he does this, when he breaks the bread, he is reminding them this is a covenant. Not only the old Passover, but this new Passover is a covenant. And what he tells them is, what does he say when he gives them the bread?
This is my body.
This is my body. So when we say this is my body, that you lose the emphasis. This is my body. I will be that animal that gets split in two. I will be the one who, because somebody broke the covenant, I will be split in two. I will be the one. So when he says that, when he breaks that, they know it's covenant. And when he says, this is my body, they know right away he's saying, I will be the animal who gets split in half. I will be the one who pays for the covenant being broken. I don't want you to be the one who's split, because if you get split, you have no life. And my whole desire, Jesus says, my whole desire, God says, is for you to be with me. So if I make you pay, you can't be with me. I want you so much with me that I'll pay. I want you so much with me that I'll be the animal that gets split. So all that they would have known and understood somewhat. They didn't understand, of course, because the crucifixion hadn't happened, what exactly that was going to mean. But that's what he's saying as he shares the body. Now, I'm just going to add this because I think it's very cool. We have a foreshadowing, even though it's not in Matthew, and I wish it were. And I even said, I just don't understand, Matthew, why you just didn't put this in, since this is your kind of... but we do have it in Luke. Where is Jesus when he's born? Where is he put in? What is he put into? A manger. What is a manger?
Feeding trough.
A feeding trough. Right from the very beginning, we are to know that Jesus will be the one that is eaten, that he will be food. And of course, all the animal sacrifices were eaten. So let's then talk about it as we have labeled it, and it actually is labeled later in this as the Eucharist. We've talked about this word a million times, so we should remember some of the definitions. Eu, meaning good. Charis, from the charist, means three things. Does anybody remember? What does charis mean?
Grace.
Grace, or good gift, or gift rather.
Thanks.
And joy, right. So it means all three of those things. And so within this Eucharist, we're going to see all of those things. Within the Passover, which we call the Lord's Supper, which he has reminded us is the Eucharist, the good gift, the good thanks, and the good joy, Jesus does exactly what he's always been doing, and that is healing. Remember, his whole point from the beginning is to restore, and he does that by healing, by breaking down the barriers and healing the access to relationship. And so he uses Passover as an acted out parable of healing that will come through his suffering, that will come through his body. He first of all sees. Remember, there were three things when he healed. He either saw you. What were the other two?
Touch
or spoke words. Spoke words of encouragement. He does all three in the Passover meal here in the Eucharist. So he sees our need, and so he gives us food to eat. We can't sustain or nourish ourselves. The touch, I think, is really cool because we actually get the word, the English word, caress, from charis. So caress is the exact same word as charis. So, again, he says, when you eat me, I'm touching you. My body is touching your body, really and truly touching you all throughout your body. It's as if, and I think this picture, particularly when you take communion, would be so helpful because it's this picture of I'm touching you, as if someone, as if in all your deaths, in your little deaths and your big deaths and all the things that are really hard, if someone comes to you, I mean, what's the thing, what's when somebody wants to encourage you and you're in a really deep place, what do they do? Yeah. So it's like, Annie, it's okay. This death, it's actually meant to be, it's die off. And if any of you have had bacterial stuff in your body and had to take an antifungal, what happens? Exactly. And it's called die off. The bacteria in your body is dying off. And it feels like you're dying off. It's what Lisa goes through all the time. And so it's Jesus saying, it's okay. This is supposed to happen. You're supposed to be getting rid of this. It's just die off. This is supposed to be happening. You're actually coming closer and closer to home. You're actually getting rid of those things that are creating a barrier for you to see that the kingdom is here, that you are in the kingdom. It's good. It's okay. It's okay. It's this caress. So that, and it's one reason why the church from earliest on instituted the Eucharist weekly. Because think about that. I mean, if you have it only once a month or maybe once a quarter, I know churches have once a quarter, are you, for all, that whole quarter, is there not a time when you just need Jesus touching you? It's okay. It's just die off. I mean, do you save it all up for then? Or you deal with it somewhere else? It's why the church instituted Eucharist once a week. We knew that every week we were going to have die off. Every week there was going to be places where Jesus' touch would help. So many people are people who need touch constantly, right? I mean, a lot of us have different needs and love languages. Touch is one of them. And actually, everybody has the need. A lot of us, like me, have put barriers up like that and have learned to start letting them down. But that touch, Jesus says, I am touching you. My body is meant to touch you all the time, to caress you. It's okay. It's die off. It's meant to be. This is good. You're just coming home. You're getting more and more rid of the barriers. So he sees our need by giving us what we need, food, nourishment. He touches us, caresses us, actually his body touching our body. And he speaks words to fill us with comfort. In the wine, it fills us with, I'm here with you. I'm coursing through your veins here. Like this, the blood of my life. Remember, blood is always life. My life is actually, I'm pouring my life into you so that you begin to feel me, that I am with you always. It's how Matthew starts the gospel. I am with you always. And it's how he ends it. And so here, right toward the end, he's saying this with the Eucharist, speaking those words through the bread and the blood. So the Eucharist becomes a meal of death into life. Like any meal, every meal we have, unless you eat food that is not true food, any meal you have is always a death into life, right? If you eat a tomato, the tomato had to die so that it could nourish you. If you eat a hamburger, the cow had to die in order for it to nourish you, right? That's what a Eucharist is. It is a meal of death into life, death for life. So it's a meal of receiving grace, that healing touch. It's a meal of thanksgiving for seeing and meeting our needs. And it's a meal of rejoicing in reconciliation of relationship. He's now with us. He's now with us.
Jill, I have a question about that, though.
Yep.
So, like, you know, when he says in the other Gospels, like, you know, whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup. So, it's, I mean, he's talking a very specific bread, right? He's talking about a very specific cup in the Passover ceremony. So, when he says that, I don't know. I just always thought he was talking about when you celebrate this Passover meal and you have the afikoman and you have the cup of salvation, remember the new covenant. Right? So, like, I didn't really even see it as him instituting Eucharist as a sacrament to have every week, right? I saw him more as, like, speaking to the fulfillment of what Passover is. So, I don't know where... You know what I mean? Like, how do you land on we should do this every week?
Oh, I'm not saying we should do it every week. I do think he instituted a sacrament here. I actually do. He does tell us whenever you do it. He doesn't say when, doesn't say how often.
But whenever you do this, like the Passover, right? I mean, isn't that what's going on?
What he is trying to do is institute a new Passover.
Right.
So, that's a good question.
Let's remember, this is going to go to Gentiles, too. And
right.
They don't probably know anything about Passover.
Right, exactly.
So, it's probably a mixture.
You know, the fact, and this is all I can say, the fact is the very earliest records of the church celebrated it once a week. So, they felt that it was a sacrament rather than just the Passover. That's all I, you know, say about that.
Well, so they were, what they were doing is they were really wanting to set apart the seventh day as a feast day. Every week.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And so the biggest feast they have is
Passover. Yeah.
So they wanted to show that big feast every week.
Right. Exactly. As a celebration of new life, that would be. Yeah.
But they didn't do the whole Passover ceremony.
No. They just did that part. Right. Right. Those symbols.
Symbolizing them.
Yeah.
That last meal. The new Passover.
Right.
Passover.
Right.
Which is why Easter is still called Passover.
Correct.
Actually.
Right. Right.
Well, it also brought, instead of division, it brought unity.
Yes.
Because then it offered the invitation for the Gentile.
Right.
Who didn't understand the Passover.
Right, right.
You know, it's an invitation for them to participate in him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, I've been thinking about that for a long time, the whole Eucharist, Passover tie-in, and what's the appropriate kind of expression, I guess.
And you know what? Paul talks about it as being being often, not just Passover. I mean, Paul definitely talks about that. In fact, I'm trying to think. He doesn't say once a week, but he does say, he intimates, I'm thinking through 1 Corinthians, he intimates that it is done regularly.
Okay.
So we do have that in Paul.
Thanks.
So does it make sense what Jesus is doing here? For those Jews to understand that it was a covenant meal and that he says it's my body and it's my blood and that I'm the one going to be touching you, being in you, being feeding you. I'm going to be doing that through being that split animal. So that they have now this, like, they already know he's going to die. And now he's telling them this. Their minds are beginning to go, oh, whoa, like, this is bigger than I thought. This is not just about saving Israel from Roman rule. They're now beginning to really have to wrestle with a lot of this stuff. And they probably are just as confused as any of us would be, considering we know it all and we still have some, you know, not sure ideas of it. But they are beginning to understand that it is a from the beginning kind of thing, that it is meant to be that Passover, and I wonder if even they had the idea that Passover was just a foreshadowing, that here is the real thing. We know that, but now they're beginning to say, wow, our whole history was really leading up to this. Because that's, for a Jew, their whole history is about Passover. Right? Michelle, would you agree with that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty much.
And I never knew Jesus was a part of it.
Right.
Yeah, even until today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm like fascinated
yeah.
right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, like it's, yeah, it's always fun to be able to bring that in, and now it gives you, like, I mean, you personally could be a disciple sitting there going, wow, that's what you're doing here.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. Like, oh. So much more than we who don't have that background.
Yeah.
We come at it from the other side, and we have to go dig deep down in to get at what it began.
But it's just as enlightening. I mean, if you as
yes.
a Gentile go to a Passover
yes.
service, you see Jesus in the
yes,
all the way through.
Yes, all the way through. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. 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 Yeah. It's pretty beautiful.
Man, my God.
Yep. Yeah. It's
well,
it's just
the
beautiful.
Invitation. I mean, having gone to her family. The invitation in the ceremony for the outsider.
Right.
That
yes.
don't actually have.
Right.
And it's funny because in Christian churches you're like, well, you know, you need to be a member to have Easter.
Yeah.
Yes. And yet in the Passover there's room
for everybody.
Everyone
yes.
to come in and
yes.
be part.
Yeah. So true.
Yes.
Yeah. That's so true. So in that also he says, not only is this my body and this is my blood, but in it is forgiveness. And of course, again, we have that word many, forgiveness of many. So don't be tripped over that. In the Greek, which is really strange because Greek has so many words, in the Greek, there is no word for a plural all. So when you see all, it's singular all. So in order to express a plural all, the word many, the word that they use in here, this Greek word, actually means altogether abundant. It means every single corner you can find. So don't let that get tripped up. It's funny how when translators do translation, sometimes they'll change it so that we understand it, and sometimes they just leave it as, well, that's the we know the word many, we'll use many. Mm-hmm. But I think it trips us up here. So it's often used in Matthew, but it's always that abundant altogether. I think we've talked about that before. So forgiveness is given for all, versus what happens to the disciples. All the disciples fall away. They all did not. He says that to them. You're all going to prove undependable. Every single one of you are going to prove undependable, which I think is pretty fascinating. That here, 12 men who have been with Jesus from the beginning, who've seen it all, who some have already claimed as the Son of God, fall away. But that's who they are. And this is why the Passover is put in Matthew, completely surrounded by denials and betrayals. Completely. So that, and especially the disciples, Matthew puts in there especially, because remember, Matthew's including himself. He puts it in there for all of us to know. You can't, by your sheer will and force, be faithful. I don't care how much you try, you cannot be faithful. And so you are always needing the Eucharist healing. You're always needing the touch of Jesus. You're always needing the nourishment and food and life that he can give you. So utterly pardon everybody, and we always need it. We always need it. It's why Matthew, of all the disciples, of all the Gospels, pictures the disciples as just ragamuffins. I mean, just like this, they're always getting it wrong. But he does this purposely because he's writing to the religious. Because if he makes the disciples the new religious, well, then everything's done, right? But the disciples are just like everybody else. They got it all messed up. And they're always, you know, vulnerable to being messed up. And it's also, I think, why Matthew takes Peter to be the representative of all the disciples. Because he's always, not just, they're all messing it up, but he very loudly and vociferously messes up, right? And he wants that. He wants us to understand every one of us is that. No matter how good of a disciple we are all that, and we need it all. We're all little and least. So, in this section, we have death to transactional commitment into the life of Jesus commitment. What I mean by that is Jesus is not going to count on our faithfulness. He's not going to count on the disciples' faithfulness and dependability. He's going to count on his own faithfulness to his Father and his Father's faithfulness to him. That's what he's going to count on. So right there you have that nugget of the forgiveness is given to all. It's not given to those who ask for it or who repent or who say the right thing or do the right thing. Forgiveness is given to all. It's only after they've been included that they can choose to be excluded. And that is the biggest force that Matthew has. Please know that Matthew wants us to understand that. And he shows that by every single person in here never being holy enough. So, that's the Passover meal. Then we go into the garden as Jesus now wrestles with obedience. I love the fact that we have this in here, that at the very end, at the very fulcrum of everything that will happen, Jesus wrestles. And although weeks ago in here we saw Jesus in his full deity at the Transfiguration, here in the garden we see him in his full humanity. I mean, absolutely downright has a different will than the Father's. Did that surprise you? I mean, we know this so well, sometimes we skip over that. But he says, your will, not mine. He's got a different will than the Father. He's a human being. And having a different will is not a barrier. The barrier comes at what you do with that. So, Jesus' first desire here is again for the disciples to be with him. He asks that the disciples be with you. Be with him, be with him. In his suffering and in his communion with the Father. But what do the disciples do? They fall asleep. Now, when you have just had a really rough week and everything is going wrong and you can't fix it, what is one way to deal with that? Mm-hmm. Yep. Because what happens?
Sorry, I thought of something else.
What happens when you sleep?
You don't have to think about it.
Yeah, right? It's almost like you...
I was skiing with Kim this morning.
In your dream?
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say.
Yeah, that's right. I was sleeping, I was skiing.
So, yeah, so it's, so you can enter a completely different world of your own makeup, right? Mm-hmm. You can shut the world away. All those problems are done. How many of you have used sleep to run away from the problems? Yeah. I would say most of us have done it one time or another. Some of us do it more often than not. But man, you know, if it's just been hard, and even your whole body says, oh, just put me in a little cocoon, right? I just don't want to deal with anything right now. That's what's happened to the disciples here. So we have, on the one hand, Jesus wants them to be with him, and they're like, the last thing I want to do is be with anybody in the world. I just want to shut the world out. So we have these two things. And they have, it's interesting that sometimes we don't think about it, but things like sleep we can use in a power move, in a move of, I want to put a barrier between. And that's what the disciples do. That's the only power they have here. It's easier to shut the world down rather than wrestle with God. We're called to wrestle with God. And we would rather, I mean, okay, how many of you enjoy the wrestling with God? It's not like, ooh, this week I am going to wrestle with God. I cannot wait. No, it's like, I mean, this is, you know, this is going to be rough, right? So they'd much rather shut the world down. Jesus himself wrestles with God. He feels the emotional and mental anguish and distress. And the words they use here are really the words for depression. So, hence we in the holy world give depression a common name, right? And we push it away. Jesus right here is experiencing that depression, that emotional and mental stress that is so severe that they don't know what to do with it. In his full humanity, we see him struggle and wrestle here with that.
Which is probably part of the reason the disciples didn't want to be with him, too. Like, yes. You know, it's like,
yes,
oh, when
exactly.
Someone's hurting so bad.
Yes.
It's like,
yes, yes, exactly. Right, right, exactly. So Jesus wrestles, and in wrestling, it always brings out, calls for your vulnerability. And that's exactly what happens with Jesus, right? He's honest about where he's at. He knows what he's being asked to do, and what does he say to God? But before he even says that,
please,
no, I don't want to do this. This is too hard. The weight is too much. I don't want to carry this. So he's very honest with how he feels about it and how emotionally it tugs at him. That is part of the wrestling. The wrestling is being honest with who you are and what you're feeling with God. No.
But also, like, they, you know, they're like, well, for the joy set before him.
Yes.
For the joy set before he endured the cross. And, like, that's really all you want to talk about.
Right.
When it comes to your cross.
Right, right.
The joy set before you. You don't talk about, like, well, there's this honest place.
Yeah. Like, I hate it. Yeah,
and
exactly.
For pain and for.
Yes.
You know.
It's why we have a whole book called Lamentations. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's a call. We are to lament the hardness of life. Life was never meant to be like that. So yes, of course we're to lament it. And of course Jesus does that as well. Within that honesty, and only within that honesty, is he able to communicate with God and hear God then. And in communion with him, he makes a decision of how he's going to face it. So here's where we put up a barrier. We don't commune with God about it all the time, or even in our communion, we're like, yeah, but I still don't want to do that. And we decide I'm going to face it by putting some kind of barrier often, right? I'm not going to go through it. I'm going to put some kind of barrier, or I'm going to make an end around, right? I'll avoid it some way. I won't have to deal with it that way. What?
I was just thinking of Jonah.
Oh, right, exactly.
I
will flee in the other direction. Yes, right, exactly. Just like Jonah. Instead of just like Job, right? Who sat in it, who was in it.
But I think there's another thing here, too.
What's that?
And that, I mean, most of us would say we flee, and most of us would say we sleep. But, I mean, I think there's another segment that would try to wake the other people up, too.
Yes.
And, I mean, I think that's what we're seeing in our society is, you know, you have people going into places with guns and bombs and all these sorts of things. And really, they're just, I mean, and most of the time they're saying, you're asleep, and I'm in pain.
Right, exactly.
You're separate,
exactly.
And I'm in pain, and
yes.
So I'm going to wake you up with a blast.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so I think there's lots of different things besides, you know, the sleep that
we would agree with you.
To try to manage the situation.
Right. So all of them are force. That is overt force. Because we're in the society we're in, we would use subversive force more, right? But that's a good point. So Jesus decides that he's going to face the suffering, that he is actually going to face it, though not as a bad thing. He will face it as a good thing. And this is then where for the joy set before him comes in of Philippians. He's going to say it's God's goodwill. I don't like it. It's going to be painful. I think it's going to be horrendous. But somehow it's still God's goodwill. That's what he makes a decision as. Because this is how he does it. He says, my Father, he identifies God as the one who provides, who cares for, who protects, who loves. Take the cup. And the cup, whenever it's talking about this, interesting that he just had in the Eucharist, in the Passover, he had all these cups. He had the disciples take several cups. And when we go through the Passover, there are four different cups. There's all different cups. They each have a different symbol. But this cup, this is the symbol of God's cup of wrath on all separateness, on all independence, on all the barriers that are put up against reality of God's rule. Yet not my will, but yours. I would see that your will is a good will. I don't like it. I don't understand it, but I believe that it is a good will. What he does here is he offers his Abba, his Father, what Israel could not offer, and that was obedience. Remember that he acts as a representative of Israel, and Israel is supposed to be a representative of the world. Israel is supposed to be the priest of the world who will bring the blessings of God, who will bring the kingdom of God. They are not able to do it. They are not able to be obedient. So Jesus, as Israel's representative, gives the Father the obedience that Israel couldn't. So always, always keep it in the Jewish context, because in the Jewish context, it is the Jewish people who are supposed to be the priests of the world. And so Jesus becomes their representative. And this is why it happens here. It's what happens with all the religious of the Jewish people. So in here, he encounters a death to his own will and life in God's will. So those are the sections of finding holy in the common. We go into finding compassion in the law. The holy people, the religious people, see the law as an end. Jesus, however, sees the law as a beginning. It's a revealing of need and therefore makes an emptiness a space for that need to be met. So you see the difference? Holy people, religious people, see the law as an end. This is what you're supposed to do, and that's all there is. Jesus and God, on the other hand, see the law as a beginning that creates a space that says, look, you can't do this. You need somebody to do it for you. You need this, and you can't do it. Now will you be willing to be filled? So it creates that hole, that invitation space for someone else to care, for someone else to give you what you need. Compassion, law tells you where you're wrong. Compassion, which is Jesus' one word throughout here, feels with you where you are, where you've been hurt by your wrongs. So compassion is with you in where you're wrong. And that's a huge thing, because we do tend to think about compassion as being with someone who has been hurt by the outside, right? But in reality, compassion is being with you where you're wrong, being with you where you have chosen to be separate and independent. Because that's really where the hurts are much stronger. So we have the arrest and the trial. Jesus submits to both of these without using any what we call right-handed power, any force. Contrasted with every other character in these next couple, in these several verses, uses their power to get their picture done. So we have, we know from other Gospels that it's Peter who tries to cut off. I am surprised, Matthew, that he doesn't name Peter here, that he just says a disciple. And I think he does that for a purpose. He wants them to know it's a disciple. Like it's any of us could have done this, that cuts off the ear of the Malchus, of the slave of the high priest, which always makes me crazy that the high priest has a slave. Jesus rebukes the use of force. And what does he say? What does he say to the disciple who cuts off the ear or takes out the sword? I don't even know, but does he cut off the ear in this one? I think he just tries to, right?
Cut off the ear.
Okay. Yeah. What does he say? Mm-hmm. Don't use it. Why?
We'll die by it.
Yeah. Anyone who uses the sword will die by it. Which is really interesting to realize that Jesus knows he's going to his death. He's going to a violent death, and he was a nonviolent person. Right here, what we know, when he says that, right here what we know is he's not going to pay for his own violence. He's going to pay for everyone else's violence. So right there, when he says that, we know that he understands, and that we should understand that the way he dies is not according to who he is, but according to who everybody else is. Before this, we had Judas, of course, using his power to try to hand over Jesus to them. Lots of speculation. We don't know for sure what Judas's thoughts were, but we know Judas was a zealot. So, do you know what a zealot was? Anybody? A zealot was someone, a Jewish person, who was nationalistic, who was trying to protect Israel and wanted Israel to finally be independent. And they were a rebel force, really. Any rebel force in any of the countries we hear about would be called zealots. Judas was one of those. And this is the very beginning of the zealot parties. In truth, the organization of zealots didn't come into just right before Rome takes the temple down. So Judas is in the very beginning. So he's kind of different than everybody else. And he wants Israel to have what God meant it to be, the center of the world, the center of God's home. Because of that, many people believe that Judas's desire here to betray Jesus was not so that he would be killed, but so that he would be forced into taking the throne finally and getting Israel where it's supposed to be. So that's most of the people I've ever read have assumed, because of who he is, that that's really Judas's point. Judas continues to be a disciple. He continues to believe in Jesus, but he believes in Jesus in his picture, right? This is what Jesus is. He's the Messiah. He's the one who's going to save Israel. He's going to be the one who throws everybody's Israel's enemies out. And now Jesus isn't going to do it. He can see, wow, it's like, what's going on, Jesus? So he feels he's doing a good thing by what he does. He's going to force Jesus' hand. Now Jesus is going to have to, which is why we have that twist of all of a sudden now he regrets it, because Jesus is going to maintain his nonviolence and submit to all of that, and he's not going to rise up and become what Judas thought he was. So we have Jesus refusing to defend himself from death in many ways, in the arrest and in the trial both. In the arrest, he says to them, why are you treating me like what? A robber, he says. Why are you treating me like a robber? We've had this word twice before. A robber is someone who takes obviously what is someone else's and hides it. Remember, we talked about that the Pharisees were robbers because they were taking the kingdom of God away from God and hiding it. And he says, this is not who I am, and you know this. I have been offering the kingdom of God everywhere I go, and I have been right there for you to take me. You know this is not who I'm at. What he's doing is asking them, why are you coming the way you're coming? Why are you afraid of me? Anytime Jesus asks, or what we look at as a rebuke, almost always it's an invitation. Almost always Jesus is asking an invitation. His questions are to get them to answer the questions for themselves. Why are you doing it like this? Why are you coming with swords and clubs to come and get me? You know that's not who I am, and you know I won't resist. We have that versus Judas, all of Israel, and Rome in different ways using their power to bring about their picture. So Judas, he now finds out that Jesus is not going to rise up. And so what does he do with what he has?
He throws the coins back out of the temple.
Okay. I mean, almost a reverse of what Jesus did, right? He threw the coins out of the temple. Mm-hmm. Judas throws them right back in. Fine, go on with your transactions. I mean, it is that power move of, I mean, I don't know if you've ever thrown anything in your life because you were angry, but when you do, your first instinct is, that'll show them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Put your phone exactly.
Yeah.
Actually, a friend of mine was just saying that the other day. She got mad, and she threw her phone, it broke, and it put a dent in their nice wood floors. And she's like, every time I see that dent, it reminds me of how stupid I was.
My sister was mad at her dog and broke her finger.
I thought you were going to say she threw the dog.
Oh. So he throws back the money, and then what does he do? He kills himself. He hangs himself. Does that remind you of what we watched? Was it last week? Mm-hmm. Who? Javert, right? Javert says, I cannot deal with this. The law is the end. See, people there, the religious people, see the law as the end. And if the law no longer works, there is nothing else to do. I just might as well give my life away because there's nothing else to do, which is exactly what Judas does. We then have all of Israel, the chief priests, and then all the people. We have them in the courtyard as Jesus is before Pilate. What do they use to get their picture performed? What does the crowd do? What does the chief priest and the crowd do?
They ask for him to be crucified.
Yeah. Ask for him to be crucified. In fact, what they do is they start a riot, which is the one thing Rome will not tolerate, absolutely not tolerate. So they know that's their power. We can do this. We can start a riot, and we can start shouting for crucifixion, crucifixion, to get what we want. And what do they want? They want Jesus crucified, but what else do they want?
Barabbas.
Yeah, they want Barabbas released. Interesting here, right? What does the word Barabbas mean? You should know this enough. It's two words, Bar, Abba, son of the Father. They want a son of the Father that's like them, that's transactional, that's strong and powerful, because they know how to deal with that. They know how to deal power against power. They don't want a son of the Father, a son of Abba, who lets it all come into him. They don't know what to do with that. Like, I just don't know what to do with that. And then we have Rome, which is symbolized by Pilate. What does Pilate do?
He washes his hands,
which is the strangest thing, because he's already gone too far, right? He now washes his hands, but he's the only one who can give authority for crucifixion. Mm-hmm. Jews cannot crucify. Rome has to. Rome is the only one who has any authority to kill. And here he says, I wash my hands, but now go and crucify him. So all of these powerful, powerful ways are completely ridiculous. Like the throwing of the money, once we throw something, we see how ridiculous and how it doesn't achieve our ends here. What we then have is Jesus being questioned, and he's questioned by many people. His questions, though, again, remember, anytime Jesus questions, it's almost always, and I can't think personally of any time he doesn't, it's almost always an invitation. So hear what he's saying. So when he says, are you the Messiah? Are you the King of the Jews? Are you the Son of God? He says, so you have said. Now this is not a yes, I am. This is not a no. And it's not, I'm not going to tell you. It's so you have said. This is an invitation. Well, you're saying that. What is it exactly you mean by Messiah? What is your picture of Messiah? Is that God's picture? Are you willing to have your picture changed? Are you willing to wrestle? That's all in that question. So you have said, what is it that you're asking? What is it that you mean? Do you see how he uses his questions always to invite? Let's wrestle with that. Because this is not an answer to their question. It is an invitation. It is a, let's think about that. You said I was Messiah. Well, what do you mean by that? And then he says, you will see the Son of Man coming enthroned. Again, a question is, if you tell someone, you tell your kid, you're going to see a parade today, what does the kid do a whole day? Is he not looking for it all the time? Like, is that it? I mean, if you're picking someone up at the airport, I'm going to be coming out of the airport at somewhere around 5 o'clock, and you're sitting there waiting. What are you looking for? You're looking, right? That's all you're looking. So when he says you will see, he's saying, start looking, because the Son of Man is going to begin to be in charge here. You're going to start looking. It is an invitation. It is not this is what's going to happen. It's an invitation. It's a start looking for this. So in this, in how Jesus responds to force against him, he dies to defending himself into a life of inviting. So we always think about, well, of course you've got to defend yourself, and Jesus tells us over and over again, you don't. Change that. Die to that. Instead, invite. When force has come up against you, opportunity to invite rather than defend. Do you see that every time Jesus dies to one of these, there's always life on the other side of it? His whole life has always been about dying so that a new life can come, a different kind of life, a different way of being a human being, actually. All right, I want you to put your notes down, get up. I want two circles, just one over there and maybe one farther back and one over here. Yeah, so this circle here. Andy, you want to take a ball? And this circle here. A couple more here. All right. We're just playing the old-fashioned game, hot potato. So, start taking the ball around, and I'm not doing music. I'm just going to stop it at some point. All right?
What? Are you playing?
No, I'm not. Go! Hurry. Stop. Okay, you need to get out. Those who have the ball, give it to someone else. All right, go. Stop. Okay, that person out. Start again, go. Stop. That person out. Again. Go. Stop. Oh, stop. One more. Ready, go.
We were already going. We're so eager.
Stop. Okay. Go ahead and bring the balls back in, right?
In one hand.
Yeah, you're done.
Good job crossing the midline.
I mean, that one will work. I have no idea what these balls are.
They're lacrosse balls.
Mm-hmm. Are they?
They look like it.
Yeah.
I knew it was a sport that I had never played. Okay. You'll find out why we did that in a minute.
Why we all have like a little anxiety attack going on.
Yeah. Okay. And that's so interesting. It's so interesting to watch it. I mean, like, no one wants that ball, right? Absolutely no one wants to keep that ball. No one wants to be out. No one wants to hold on to that. So what we're coming now to is the crucifixion. What an odd way, though, to picture the crucifixion, right, in a game of hot potato. What we have now here is Jesus trusting God, contrasted with mocking and threats. Anytime we have mocking and threats, we know it's going to be the opposite of trusting. And we'll look at that in a second. What Jesus does, and we've talked about this with the white rags before, is absorbs all of the evil in trust as King of the Jews. What the rest of the people do is they mock and they threat. Where's the threat? Well, the sign that they put over Jesus, King of the Jews, not only, we always consider it just a mocking, but actually all criminals got a sign put over them when they were crucified. Do you know why? Why would you put a sign over them?
Say what they did wrong?
Yes, and why?
A warning to others.
Yes, a warning. You do this, done. And so for Jesus, when they put up King of the Jews, what they were saying is, you join this rebellious group? No way. You are not going to play with who is at rule here. Because any king is always a force against the rule that is in power, right? So it's a warning. Absolutely, you are not. It is, again, that puffed up power. Absolutely not. You're not playing with us. You're not going to play with the rule that is in power right now.
But that's amazing because God's message was there.
Yes.
I mean, God's message was, this kingdom is about death.
Yep. Yep, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so all of these things, as you go deeper into each of these little pieces, you see that God's will is being played out by the hands of the people who think that they're protecting their own little pictures every single time. It becomes more and more and more clear, and it will become the clearest as we get to the resurrection. But we see it right here as playing right into God's hands, just as everyone, including Satan, always does. So when you were playing the hot potato ball, this is what happens with all the barriers that we put up and all the violence and all the force and all the independence that we put up. When someone is independent, it's against you because I don't want to be with you. If someone is violent, they're pushing you away. If I'm making a barrier, so we often don't think about barriers as being evil, but they are, considering we are made for relationship. So all of those things are really this hot potato. And the thing is, if I don't want it, if I don't want someone to be like that to me, then I'm going to give it away, right? Like I don't want it. I'm going to push it away. And now Annie does. Do you want to play with that? No, absolutely not. And so this is what happens in hot potato, right? No one wants that. And so they choose to deal with it in the only way we know, in transaction, right? I don't want it. You take it. I'm going to give you what you just gave me, or I'm going to give someone else what some. How many of you, somebody was really mean to you or crabby or stupid, and you were, you know, like you looked at them and smiled, oh, bless your heart. And then you walk away, and what happens?
You're mean to someone else.
So we don't want to take that hot potato, right? We don't want to hold it. So we will always do something with it, right? What does Jesus do?
Eats it.
He eats it. He takes it all, and 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 he holds it. And he says, it's done. The only way of stopping that is for someone to absorb it, to hold it, to take it. It no longer now continues to be something in motion, continuing on and on and on and affecting everyone.
And no longer excludes
the ball stops.
And it no longer excludes anyone. No one's out anymore. No one has to, except the one with all the balls. Does that make sense? Exactly. Exactly. So that is that absorbing for him. That is that hot potato. And these are bills, and I didn't know what they were, so I wanted to write on them. I wanted to write all of the things that this week you have had violence against you in some way. You've had a barrier put up to you in some way. I had an experience this weekend that was just like one of those, I didn't do anything to you, lady. And I was at a wedding. It was sister, you know, they introduced me to her. And by the end of the night, I walked over to say, it was so nice to meet you. I have never had such, like, literally, wouldn't talk, wouldn't say anything, and then her son did the exact same thing. And of course, I got nervous. And the last thing I said was to the young man who lives in Kentucky, and he wanted me a newspaper, he's just graduated, wanted to be a newspaper person, and, you know, we talked about it, and he'd like to go anywhere in the world. And the last thing I said to him was, well, I hope you don't have to stay in Kentucky. Well, I think that just,
wow.
Yeah, they were like, there are good things in Kentucky. I didn't mean it that way. But that's what happens is you start like, wait a second here. I didn't do anything to you, and you're giving me this. I'm going to give it right back to you, and without any conscious thought. And after I left, I thought, well, that's not what I meant, but maybe I did. Maybe it was a little bit of a, you know, that's what we do with it. Jesus says, no, I'm just going to take it all, at all. And this is why he waits until a point where Rome comes at him, Israel comes at him, his disciples leave him, everything comes at him all at once. They've been trying since the very beginning. In fact, we have Satan as baptism coming at him over and over again. We have the priests plotting and plotting and plotting. We have it until everyone comes against him. He's going to take it all now and pull it down into himself. So he dies to all the independence, all the barriers that are trying to protect people's kingdoms that Israel could not. That Israel absolutely just couldn't do, couldn't die to that. He does. He takes it all. And then he's a naked priest at the end. Completely naked priest. And again, remember, he's always the representative of Israel first. And Israel the representative of us. And so he becomes that representative now of Israel who couldn't do it, who have all these barriers and all of these independence. And because of that, because of taking on all the barriers that Israel has put up, God is now obscured for him. And this is where we get the, my God, why have you forsaken me? Notice two things in here. He can't see God, he can't feel God, he can't hear God, because he's taken on all the barriers. And secondly, what else has changed here? What are the words? What does he say? My God. My God instead of Father. He is now where every man is. He can't see Father. He can only see God. And now even God is taken away from him. The barriers have completely obscured. His lifeline has been cut. And so he addresses my God rather than Abba, like any other man. And God will always give what is finally asked for. And in those barriers, what is asked for is, stay away from me. He will not force his presence, and so he allows the veil to remain. The veil of his body, the veil that he created, the barriers that he took on, he allows that to be there. And then we have Jesus yielding up his spirit. By the way, when he questions using Psalm 22, which if you finish this, I think we had to go through that, right? We had to read through that. At the end of the psalm, it's a psalm of trust. I don't know what you're doing. I can't figure it out, but I will trust you. It is almost the words of Job. Yet, though he slay me, I will still praise him. I will still trust him. Same thing here. That's why he uses Psalm 22. And in yielding up his spirit, he does so in trusting. Here, he is voluntarily giving up his spirit. And who is his spirit? What do we know his spirit as? The Holy Spirit. He voluntarily gives the Holy Spirit back to the Father so that God can divide and multiply the Spirit to give it out. One of the things that Matthew doesn't include that I'm just going to show you because I think it fits with Matthew anyway. Remember that Jesus is the second Adam, and so we always, a lot of these things go back to Genesis as we look. We have in Luke, I believe it is, that the soldier pierces him in his side to see if he's dead. With Adam, Adam also was pierced in his side. For what purpose? Yeah. He took, God took part of his life out of him and created his bride, right? What's happening with Jesus when he gets pierced by the side? What runs out of it?
Water
and blood. When you have your children, what runs out of you first? Water first, then blood. It is the birthing of the bride, the birthing of his body, the birthing of the church that happens as he gives part of his life, as he gives his life. The loss of both the Father and the Spirit here. The Father is obscured. He gives up the Spirit. This is the moment where he becomes the split animal. This is the covenant moment where he becomes the split animal. The Father and the Spirit. In fact, in that picture in Abraham, it's the Father and the Spirit who walk through the pieces, right? And the pieces are laying there dead. This is the picture. This is what really has happened here. The result, we have several things that Matthew, and only Matthew, says. All of them say that the curtain of the temple was torn. So we know, we just on Hebrews, we know what is the picture of the torn curtain. That is what?
Separation, access to.
What's the veil?
The Holy.
The curtain.
Oh, the body.
Jesus' body.
Jesus' body, right. So again, we have the picture of, it's that split in half animal. It's his body. It's. The curtain has always been a barrier, right, to the Holy of Holies, to the place where God dwells. Jesus has taken on all those barriers that we put up. Mm-hmm. He's taken that on to be the veil. And now he splits himself open to pay back that contract that was broken. So sin here is canceled and the barrier is open. And heaven and earth are beginning to be rejoined. When that temple curtain opens, heaven and earth are rejoined. And I think we've talked about this before, but a lot of times we talk about, now we have access into the Holy of Holies, but what's the other side of it? God can now come out of the box that we've put him in, can come out and be in the world. It is heaven, it is holy and common together. It is heaven and earth beginning to be rejoined here. When heaven and earth begin to be rejoined, what do you think is going to happen to the earth? It's going to start shaking because the earth is just as much in need of heaven returning to it as people are. And so, of course, the earth is going to shake. There's lots of things in here, and I'm not going to go through it all. Split rocks. I mean, we have split rocks all the way in Exodus. What happens when split rocks come?
Water
comes out and feeds and begins, of course, and we have Jesus there. And we have open tombs. Everything is affected when barriers are broken. And one thing I will say here, it's kind of an odd series of events that Matthew does. That Matthew talks about the bodies coming out of the tombs before Jesus comes out, which is odd, right? So I'm only going to give you a slight idea of what's going on here. This is fascinating to me, but take a class. Time in the kingdom of heaven is very different than time here, right? What we have here is Matthew giving us just a glimpse of the two times crashing together. Of all of a sudden, our time is not simple. It doesn't just go from here to here to here. And we've got all of heaven's time. Remember, heaven and earth are be joining here. They're starting to be joined here. And so all of a sudden, things are kind of mixed up for us. From seeing it from this side, well, wait, that's supposed to happen first, and then that, and then that. But in heaven, there isn't a linear time. Does this make sense? So that's just a little idea of heaven's time is starting to insert here.
But death was already absorbed.
Death, yes.
I mean, so that's
correct.
The finished work.
That's the finished work, exactly. But for us, we're thinking, well, why isn't Jesus is the first fruits? Why isn't he coming up first? Why are all these?
It said that, but they didn't come into the city and appear until after the resurrection.
Correct. As far as our time goes, though, they came up before Jesus came up. They became alive before Jesus came alive, as far as we know from this. All I'm saying is, all Matthew's doing is inserting a little bit of, hey, heaven and earth are joined now. They're beginning, and you're going to start seeing some things that maybe don't make sense to you in earthly time, as far as time. Because remember, there's time, there's space. Oh, I forget the other one. The three dimensions that we have, heaven has in a different way. That's all I'll say about that. Some kind of crazy ideas of what's going on. So what is Jesus dying to in this part? Mostly dying to unbelief, to distrust, into a life of trusting God's good. This is exactly what he did. Remember, again, he continues to use his human mind. He's dying, still not knowing exactly what's going on. Everything he knows from Scripture. Yet he trusts that God is good in all of this. He trusts even in the horrific stuff that's happening. And I have to say, and this is so petty, but we've just had lots of things fall apart and monetarily just horrendous things all at once. Not the year that this needs to happen. And Monday I went into the dentist because my tooth wasn't feeling right. And he said, you need a root canal. I'm in the chair, and I'm just like, that has always been one of my fears. My mom had a lot of problems with it. And the word root canal, like my whole body, even saying it, my whole body's just, and I remember praying, okay, God, I'm going to trust you that this is good. I cannot see how this is good. I'm wrestling, and I'm feeling like, I know that that's so petty for what Jesus went through, but there is that. I'm going to trust you. I hate it, and I don't want pain, and I don't want expense, but this is good. Somehow this is good. I want to live in that place where I know this is good, even though I don't know what's going on, and I don't know the pain. And, of course, my first question is, tell me how much pain it's going to be. And, of course, as a dentist, unless this happens, and then you will want to strangle. That's what he said to me. Yes, that was reassuring.
I had one and there was no pain at all.
Mine's under a crown. So that's a little more of a problem.
Well, they just have to take the crown off.
No, they don't take the crown off.
Right through it.
Yes.
My mom's allergic to Novocaine.
Not yet. And I'm hoping that it doesn't explode.
My mom is allergic to Novocaine and has done root canals without anesthesia.
She's a better woman than I am because I want to be put to sleep. Anyway, all that to say, death to a life of distrust. Death to a life of, that doesn't sound good, I'm going to put up a barrier. That doesn't sound good, I'm going to do something about that. Rather, into a life of trust, which is what Jesus does here on the cross.
So Jesus removes the barriers we've seen all through Matthew with the barrier of the Gentiles, the women, the lepers, all the different barriers that exist in the temple. And then there's the final barrier of the curtain as his body.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I not getting that? Why is his body the final barrier?
Because he took all of this. All
so
those
the
barriers.
Final barrier is
that's all the barriers.
And so
yes.
His body is just representing the absorption of that.
Right. It's absorbed all of that. So remember, all the barriers are sin. All independence is sin. All pushing away is sin. So what Matthew has done is kind of taken that that word sin and taken it out, right? Mm-hmm. So that because as religious people, well, sin. Well, we know what sin is and we don't do that. But we do put up barriers. And we do protect ourselves and we do become independent. So that's why I'm saying that. But it also is the picture of a veil, is a barrier. So every single time I'm independent, I'm putting up a barrier. And Jesus has taken all the barriers and he has filled himself up with all the barriers. Therefore, his body is the veil.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I would really love to read a story out of Brennan Manning, but it's long, and I think I'm going to skip that. At some point, if you want to read a really, really cool story about Brennan Manning, talking about that, He ministers to, I never knew this until I had read this before. He actually, Brandon Manning, ministered for years in Carville, Louisiana.
At the leper sanctuary.
So we read this book for our book club. Linda's read it. It's this great book. And he talks about, I love this, he talks about a Mexican-American woman named Yolanda that was a huge beauty. And then she gets leprosy, of course, and completely gets defaced. And her family leaves her. Anyways, it's a beautiful story about that and about how she hears Abba Father calling her. So if you ever get a chance, you want to read that. It's great. So now we're in the finding truth in relationship. Jesus knows that whole relationship brings life. That's what life is relationship. Religious people think truth is where life is, that it's all about truth, being right, right? I mean, that's, boy, I thought that for years and years and years, that being right was where truth was found. That was the proven facts. And so what we find, though, is that when we use facts, tactics that have been proven, it kills relationship. Mm-hmm. So we see these two contrasts here. Jesus gets prepared for a new life, contrasting with the chief priests securing against a new life. They want to make sure that new life doesn't happen, and so they secure against it. We have Jesus, we have Joseph of Arimathea coming in. What does Joseph of Arimathea do with Jesus?
He removes
the
body, right?
Yeah, removes the body.
Burial and gives him his tomb.
Try to say it in the words that Matthew says it.
He wrapped him in a linen or clean cloth.
Mm-hmm. And?
Prepared.
And laid him in?
A tomb.
A tomb. What does that sound like?
Laid him in a manger.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And remember, what's his name again?
Joseph.
There are so many of these things in Matthew, you just want to like scream, oh my goodness. So Joseph wraps him in swaddling cloth and lays him in a tomb. The tomb becomes, of course, the womb that he is born out of again. Jesus allows his body to be cared for as a newborn. He allows the preparation for a new life here. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, the place of the tomb and the place of the manger are the exact same structures. Mm-hmm. So we always make the manger this wooden, cute little crush.
Right.
It's not. It's in a rock. It's in rocks. Mm-hmm. It's just like tombs were. And you know, I wished I had time to show you what a real tomb in Israel looks like, because it's nothing that you have in your mind. The rock, and I always thought about the rock. I always thought the rock, you know, was so hard to get, you know, in and out of. But no, they actually did open and close it all the time, because they had to go back in to do spices. They would go back in and put other bodies in. So the rock isn't actually unmovable. Very different than what I had thought. Anyway, we have the priest now begging Pilate, going to the Roman authority, and begging them to let them fight against any possibility of new life, of different life coming out again. Please, we don't want our life to change, is really what they're fighting against. Look, we've made this really nice life here. We've got a perfect gig going on here. Help us to keep it that way. And it's funny that they're asking Pilate, the Roman, to do this. And of course, Rome says yes, because we like the gig too, and let's keep it on going. But again, as we've seen all through, particularly here, what man meant for evil, God meant for good, because the sealing of the tomb makes it the impossibility of anything else happening except resurrection. If they would have not sealed the tomb and put a guard there, then when Jesus rose, any explanation could have happened. Yes, then it was possible that the disciples stole it. Yes, then it was possible that grave robbers stole it. Possible that, you know, animals came and dragged the body out. Anything. But the fact that they put a seal and a guard assured that the only thing that could have happened was resurrection. Does that make sense? So here they're trying so hard to make sure that their picture is going to be intact, just like the sign up there. And now this. And God says, thank you. This is great. Because now it's only resurrection that can explain.
So, and then you have, so that scene with Joseph, though, Mary's there too. That you were just talking about.
Yep.
There was a Mary right there.
Yep.
And a Joseph.
Yep.
And then Mary is the first one to reveal the resurrection, but she was the first one to have revealed the plan to begin with.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, Mary.
Yes. So we have notice how many Marys we have. Again, though, a picture of the starting of the kingdom multiplying and multiplying. So at the end, we have two Marys instead of at the new birth rather than one Mary. So
well, you have a Gentile Mary and a...
Yep, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. There's so many things like that happen in here. It just gets, you know, of course, more and more exciting to see all the detail God puts into this. So death to control into a life that is provided. See, Jesus is completely giving up control. He's resting on the Sabbath here and letting God take care of him through whomever he chooses. So if I let go of control, then I let God give me the life he wants to give me. And we've talked about this over and over again, letting go of control, letting go, letting go, letting go. And we see it black and white here. God will give us life if we die to the life we're trying to make. And yet we still use that power. We use everything we can to fight it. The problem is, without death, there's no resurrection. And without resurrection, there's no life. So you want to keep this life? Keep it going? Look what happens. It always ends in disaster for your picture. But, of course, not for God's picture. So we go to the resurrection. And here is beautiful because all along, the whole point of Jesus' kingdom is to heal and restore, and this is what he does in the resurrection. He heals and restores. Contrasted with the bribes against good news. We have two Marys here, we talked about that see the new birth, the new life, multiplied from the one Mary at the beginning. We have it happening on the first day of the week. Not so much to create a new Sabbath, but to say new creation. Starting all over again, here's a new creation. And again, I wish we could go to the other Gospels because there's even more. And my favorite being that the angel is mistaken for what?
A gardener.
Yeah, because we're starting all over again in the garden.
Well, and Annie and I were talking about this. Like, the first time he broke out of a womb, the second time he broke out of a tomb.
Yep.
And that's our journey.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So they are trying to keep their old creation intact. They bribe so that their way of living doesn't change. They don't want their way of living to change. And Jesus is all about your way of living changing. A completely new way of being human. When we allow God to completely, fully rule, we allow him to be completely God, it helps us to be completely human. Because completely human means being under God's rule. That's what we were created. When we're not under God's rule, we're not fully human. Part of us is missing. The tomb opens, the angel scene. Hopefully you remember this from 2 weeks ago. These were end time signs, right? That the earth would quake, that there would be a light right before the Son of Man comes. And here we have it. It's the same word that we have for the angel, this brightness that the eye cannot take its sight from. And then the angel says, go and tell. Go and tell. The old and the new are intersecting. We're seeing the old starting to fizzle away, just starting, and the new just starting to begin. And we're seeing the two intersecting. So even today, we're seeing more, it's closer, but the two still intersect. One's dying, one's coming alive. Birth pangs, right? Exactly what he told them would happen. Birth pangs start here, and they continue on. And so we continue in the birth pangs of the old going away and the new coming. And we have Jesus raised, but we also have the soldiers like dead men, which is the picture of reality. In reality, this new life is what is really true. And people that are walking around like dead men, that's true too, that don't want to have that new life. They're really like dead men. And of course, his raising by God rather than himself is the sign of God accepting that the contract, that covenant, was completed by him being torn in half. So what we have here, though, is as he meets, as the women, the two Marys, meet Jesus, he begins his ministry again, all over, because he does the healing thing. He speaks to them. He first speaks the words of comfort, greetings. One of the commentators said, he says, hi. Just like, hey, hi, it's you, it's my friend. Hey, you know, good to see you. And he allows them to touch him, which is very different than another gospel, right? Because one of the gospels says, don't touch me. I haven't ascended yet. But in Matthew's story, in Matthew's, how he wants to relate it is, Jesus is continuing the ministry of healing. And then he sees that they're afraid, and he says, don't be afraid, which is exactly what the angel said. Well, first the angel says, don't be afraid, right? Mm-hmm. In the very beginning of Matthew, what does the angel say to Joseph? Don't be afraid. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid. So it is going all the way back there. So he sees their fear, and he speaks the do not fear. But then he commands that they bring the healing elsewhere and multiply the healing and continue the healing by saying, go tell those disciples who ran away from me, who are no good, who are not my friends anymore. What does he say? My brothers. Go tell my brothers. The last thing that they did to him, the last thing Jesus saw of them, was them running away, was them denying. Mm-hmm. And he says, go tell my brothers. You see, the forgiveness, his forgiveness, all he did for them, his reconciliation with them, stands on its own. Mm-hmm. It's not there if they come to him and say, we're sorry. The reconciliation is done. They are included in it. They are his brothers. Now it's for them to reject it. But it's already there. He's already there. They're his brothers already. It's, again, Matthew puts in this over and over again, inclusion before exclusion. It's already done. You can only push it away. And the result, of course, is worship. Yes, God is with us. Death to old creation into a life of new creation. And then we have the very end of Matthew, the commission, where Jesus multiplies the family. And now there is no contrast, because now it's a continuation of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. So Matthew takes all the way from the beginning, and he says, okay, now we're going to continue on. Let's say the next generation and the next generation. And this is what the commission is all about, that the genealogy of Jesus Christ continues. So it starts where the healing ministry began. He sends them to Galilee. Did anybody ever think about that? Because I think when we think about it, we think that they're still in Jerusalem. But he sends them to Galilee, and he says to the mountain in Galilee. We don't know, but what mountain do you think it is? What mountain would be special to Jesus and his disciples? What mountain in Galilee did he start his ministry with? The Mount of the Beatitudes. Whatever mountain that is, that's probably where he's sending them to. That's where I'm going to meet you. Why do you think? Why would that be a place for Jesus to meet, to continue his genealogy? What's the Sermon on the Mount all about?
Living in the kingdom.
About you being empty, right? Start with you being empty, ready to receive, so I can fill you. If it doesn't start there, disciples will go out as religious people. But to start at the Mount of Beatitudes means I start with the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the empty. Blessed are the least. Blessed are the little. Because it is when you start empty that I know I don't have it. I know I can't die to all these things. I can be filled with Jesus' death of dying to all these things. And then I can overflow with that. He says to them, all authority has been given to me on heaven and on earth. And what he's saying is, heaven and earth have started to come together again. The veil has been torn down, and you're beginning to see it. It's always been there, but there's been a veil. The king has begun to reign in the restored kingdom. Heaven and earth are rejoining. So, he says, as you're going and as you're living, so just so you know, when it says go, therefore, that's not a command. The command is not to go. So many times we've used that as the command is for us to go. Okay, that is not. It is as you are going, as you are living, is what the words are. As you're living your life day by day, do these things. The command is disciple, baptize, and teach. So as you're going, as you're living, disciple all nations. Anybody, you now have my right and my ability. That's why he says, I have the authority. I'm giving it to you. You have my right and my ability to bring healing. As my life courses in you, as my life, the one that's broken all the barriers by absorbing and healing them, now you can do that in my life. You can't do it on your own. You can do it as my life. In other words, let my life begin to be that seed that grows in you into being a tree for the birds. You go out and heal. You go out and be the tree that the birds can come to. The disciple here means to mentor or live with. So when we think disciple, it's not particularly I have a meeting with this person, you know, once a month, and I do this, and this is how I disciple. Disciple is actually to do life with. Then he says to baptize, and we've talked about this, but the word baptize means to identify. And when he says baptize them in the name of, he's saying give them the identity of being a son of the Father, being a brother to the Son, being an inheritor of the family spirit. Identify them that. Because when I name them as such, I will treat them as such. When I name that person out there as a son of the Father, as a brother to Jesus, as an inheritor of the family spirit, then I treat them that way, right? I treat them. At this wedding I went to, she has three sisters. One of the sisters couldn't come up, and so we were the only people that weren't family. We were invited to be the place of the family, the sister. So I was treated as the sister in that family. I was named as, well, this is my substitute sister. So that's when we name someone as a son of the Father, as a child of the Father, as a brother of the Son, we treat them that way, right? That's the big thing about names, as we do that. So, mentor them, live with them, identify them as children of the Father, brothers of the Son, and teach. Teach them the family business, which is reconciliation, healing. All I've commanded, Jesus says, all I've commanded is about healing, is about restoration, is about loving the Lord and loving others into Trinity relationship. And that will flow out only of your own filled emptiness, not filed emptiness, filled emptiness and littleness. And then he says, and don't forget, I'm with you in all of this, always. Matthew ends his gospel as he began his gospel. And so, Emmanuel, God with us, is truly with us. And no more death but living to the new life. In the end, love wins. I still think that is the best summarization of what Jesus has done, because life is about relationship. It's about that Trinitarian relationship of God with us with others, others with God, that nice Trinity that makes us whole and who we were created to be. Father, we thank you that... thank you just seems really inadequate, and I have no words, but I give you our praise and our worship and our adoration and our awe that you have absorbed all of our barriers. There are no longer any barriers. May we rejoice. May we name one another as children of yours. May we celebrate. May we eat your body. May we feel the caressing as we die to all of these things as only we can with your life coursing through our veins. We praise you for the gift of Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name, amen. Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. You know, there's a lot. There's a really lot. So next week, remember our review. I do want you to come with to share something. I want you to share, first of all, before you even review, which I do want you to do, I want you to really be in prayer as, what is it that you have touched me with this semester? Because there's been so much. And I've done a terrible job of reviewing so that we can keep it all as a package. And I have felt overwhelmed with, I don't know how to bring this as a package. So really be in prayer about what is it, God, that you want, that you, first of all, that you've touched me with, that I remember right away, and that you want me to continue to wrestle with. Whether it be any of the excursions that we've done, any of the lessons that we've taught, or even maybe something that God has brought out of that has touched and you've gone on a different tangent. I would love to hear where God has had you in each of these things. I'll tell you, I mean, there's so much in here that I know a lot of times, and I've really tried hard this time not to give us as much stuff, but how do you not do that in Matthew? I mean, how do you not do that in a gospel? But then after you've prayed, go through the lessons and see if there isn't something that reminds you of, oh, I forgot about that and that I really wanted to keep that. I would love for you to bring an object that represents something that God has touched you with in Matthew. So an object that represents it. Because Matthew has done such a good job of doing that in so many places, it can be just something that you have. I mean, you know, if you brought a ball saying that, you know, the absorbing or the white cloth, think through that so that it gives each of us a visual of the fact that God is actually working in each of your lives in different ways. I know that there are all sorts of pieces of Matthew that hit each one of you differently. My goal and my desire is that you not just use this as a, wow, I learned a lot. And if somebody asks me 3 weeks from now, I couldn't tell you a single thing. I really want you to take some time with reviewing and see where God wants you to continue to wrestle with. Because you've got a long time. I mean, this is still April. So you've got May, June, July, and you've got 4 months. I'm hoping that you're going to wrestle with something in Matthew throughout that time. You may be in another study, but I don't think we study the gospel and leave it at that. So,
you want us all to come back with cauliflower ears from the wrestling?
From what?
Cauliflower ears from wrestling.
Oh, from wrestling. Oh, okay. yeah. Yes, that would be great. So that's what I'd love you to do. So make sure you write. Did the sheet go all around if you're going to be at the brunch? Yeah.
Back on the table.
Okay, so make sure I know that. Make sure you bring food, some kind of food. And we'll have a nice... And you know what? It looks like next week is really pretty.
Yeah.
So at least we'll have the windows open. If it's really nice, I might set it up outside.
Yeah.
So I feel like we need to be outside. So we'll do that, and then we'll garden the week after that. So that's kind of where it's at. So I would ask prayers that my tooth does not erupt as Sherilyn and I leave for New Mexico tonight. I know. You know, of course, I said, so, like, I'm going out of town. You know, I can't. He goes, well, it could be okay. And then it could just erupt.
He sounds real
this is a friend of ours. This is the person we've known the longest in the western suburbs.
I think he's being honest.
Yes. And he said, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to write you a prescription for a painkiller and an antibiotic. And, you know, just take that with you just in case. And then when you come back, you can have. But he did one thing. he actually, so he drilled me without anything. He just took the drill. He said, I'm just going to drill a little. Don't worry. Because I have, there's one thing in here that might help. And actually it has helped. So I, right now it's not too sensitive. But I would ask for prayers for that. Because then Sherilyn's going to really have a ruined vacation. Yeah, mine will be ruined, definitely. Yes. Yes, as I'm wrestling with, this is supposed to be good. So I would appreciate that. Otherwise, I will see you next week.
Are you guys gone through the weekend?
We are. We are. Yes. So we're going to a conference for 2 days and 2 days having fun.
Oh, that's awesome. So it
in
should Santa be fun. Fe, right?
Santa Fe and Albuquerque, yeah. I know.
I'm not kidding. It's one of my favorite places.
Really?
In the whole world.
Oh, it's one place I've not been.
So that narrows it down.